Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Maybe you've read the book Rocket Boys or seen the movie it inspired called October Sky. The main character, who would eventually become a NASA scientist, revered the life and work of one particular Cold War-era scientist named Wernher von Braun. Here's von Braun explaining rocket flight in space.
When all the sections are joined together, the ship and its crew will be ready for man's first flight in space.
What the movie ignores and the book only briefly refers to is von Braun's past as a high-ranking Nazi scientist who used slave labor to build his rockets for Germany. He was among some 1,600 Nazi scientists taken in by the U.S. after Germany fell, taken in part to help the U.S. fight the rest of the war, but also to prepare for the next Cold War. Joining us now is the author of a book about this episode in American history, Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. Welcome to the show, Annie Jacobson.
Thank you for having me.
Your book asks two big questions. How did this happen, and what does it mean now? Let's start with the first question. These guys were war criminals. We still read about Nazi war criminals being hunted down and brought to trial. How did the U.S. pull this off?
Well, the interest in Operation Paperclip for me began when I was writing my earlier book called Area 51, and I came across two Nazi aircraft designers who designed the all-wing Horton 5, which looks a lot like our B-2 bomber. Now, the Horton brothers did not become part of Paperclip, but I learned about this program, and I learned specifically that they had a boss named Siegfried Knaemeyer, who came to the United States right after the war and worked for the Department of Defense. When he retired in the mid-70s, this is Siegfried Knaemeyer, he was given the Distinguished Civilian Service Award by the Defense Department. That is the highest award they can give someone who's not in uniform. And looking into Siegfried Knaemeyer and this strange program called Operation Paperclip, I learned that during the war, during World War II, Knaemeyer was so important to the Luftwaffe. He was the head of all technical engineering developments for the German Air Force, that Hermann Göring, perhaps the most odious person of the Third Reich after Hitler, Hermann Göring called Siegfried Knaemeyer my boy. That's how close they were. And I thought, how do you go from being that important to the German Luftwaffe to being that important to the U.S. Department of Defense? And that began my inquiry into how did this happen?
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Annie Jacobson. She's the author of a new book. It's called Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. Operation Paperclip began in 1944. Can you talk about the scene in Germany at that time and how the U.S. originally got involved with Nazi scientists?
To learn about what happened, who these scientists really were they involved in nefarious acts during the war? I begin the book in the fall of 1944. It's November, so it's just been a few months since the Normandy landings. And I learned that peppered among the soldiers is this highly classified intelligence unit called Operation Alsace. And instead of being led by, you know, soldiers, it's led by physicists, and that specifically a particle physicist named Samuel Goudsmit. And Goudsmit has been tasked by the U.S. Army intelligence to find Hitler's scientists. He's been tasked to actually find the weaponry that Hitler has been building, atomic, biological, and chemical weapons. They called it ABC warfare. And so Goudsmit is hunting, and his team, they're hunting for anything they can find that we know very little about it. And the book begins in Strasbourg, France. The Allies haven't even made it into Germany yet. And that is where they get their first big lead about what exactly Hitler has been up to.
It's kind of like the Monuments Men, but they're looking for scientists instead of art.
Absolutely. And this was a huge threat. So just to go back in time to that period, that dark, terrifying period, you've got V2 rockets raining down on European cities, particularly London, Paris, Antwerp. And these V2 rockets are called Wunderwaffe, wonder weapons. And they're terrifying, not because they're precise, but because they land where, you know, wherever they land, they sort of wreak havoc and kill people and destroy buildings. But the real fear for the Allies is not the is not those V2 rockets themselves. It's what might Hitler put in the nose cone. In other words, if he puts biological weapons or chemical weapons in that nose cone, that rocket is going to have such a greater, more dramatic effect on the population that it lands in. And so that's what they were looking for. And lo and behold, our scientists found out that the biological weapons program and the chemical weapons program that the Third Reich had been pursuing was far advanced than even our worst fears.
There were 1,600 Germans that were recruited for this operation. That sounds like a lot of people. Do we have any sense about how many among them were actually considered war criminals?
Well, I focus on 21 of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so much of this, of a story like this, is how it gets reported, because so much of the story is how was this hidden? How was this kept secret from the American public? And so, the 1,600 is an important number, although it's accurate now. But perhaps that number will change as more information is revealed. But either way, the government knew that in 1946, when it began bringing German scientists to America, only, you know, months after the end of the war, that someone was going to notice. You could have these Germans in classified military facilities, but the plan was to eventually second them to universities where they would work in laboratories for longer, you know, longer periods of time. And so the government made a public face to Paperclip, and they promoted the idea, these are the good German scientists. These are the ones who, you know, hid out and sort of tried not to be, you know, pulled into the Nazi ideology. And that is, of course, as I learned, and as others before me have reported, that is utter fiction.
One example that I mentioned earlier, Werner von Braun, at the top of the show, he's probably one of the most famous Nazi scientists that worked for America, but he was always portrayed as a reluctant Nazi, as you said. Was that at all accurate about him?
You know, the von Braun story is so complex because you see that not only did von Braun hide his past, but the U.S. government was really complicit in helping him, once he got here, to whitewash his past. Because we found out a lot of things about von Braun, what he was doing during the war, that I learned from these recently declassified documents that really portray the reality of what was going on with von Braun. And I'll tell you a little bit, I'll give you an example. Von Braun, as you mentioned in the various books and movies that are made about him, he's sort of, it's very easy to talk about the rocket facility, the early years of the Third Reich, and there was a facility on the Baltic Sea called Peenemünde, and they sort of, this is positioned as sort of a scientific laboratory by the sea with these men of science, you know, dreaming about space travel and rockets, and that, of course, was so far from the truth. In fact, these people, von Braun, his boss, General Dornberger, who I also profile, Arthur Rudolph, Kurt Davis, 115 of these Nazi rocket scientists came to America, and they were all very high up and very well received among the Third Reich, no one more so than von Braun, who visited with Hitler several times. But the real crimes of von Braun lay in the last sort of 9 months of the war, when von Braun was not at Peenemünde because it had been bombed by the British, but rather the whole operation moved into this dark, apocalyptic, underground tunnel factory where prisoners from concentration camps were brought to work as slave laborers, and they were worked to death in these tunnels. We now know that something like 30,000 of these concentration camp prisoners were worked to death inside those tunnels. Von Braun was in charge of the science in those tunnels. So as that story kind of creeped out a little bit in bits and pieces, and, you know, one piece here in the 60s, one piece here in the 70s, you know, it was often asked, did Von Braun know? And the answer was always absolutely not. But that was not true. We know that now. And we know that because a historian named Michael Neufeld located a document. And it is so difficult. You know, when I was doing the research for this book and I came and I read this document, it really gives you pause, because the Buchenwald concentration camp, which is probably second only to Auschwitz in terms of its public presence mm-hmm. in our consciousness. The Buchenwald concentration camp was where the slaves, many of the slaves that worked in Nordhausen, were chosen from. And in this one document, we see Von Braun himself going to the commandant of Buchenwald and hand-picking the prisoners who will become his slave laborers. You see his signature on that document. And when you read that, you realize this idea that Von Braun was a beneficent scientist and that he did not know of the Holocaust. You realize that is complete fiction, and that then you must ask yourself, how can one excuse a man from this kind of complicity in war crimes?
I was going to ask you, you know, we talked about the Pentagon's highest civilian award, the Distinguished Civilian Service Award, going to Siegfried Kinemeyer, and the adulation given to someone like Von Braun. Weren't there people in the military, other scientists, U.S. scientists, who wouldn't work with them?
You know, that is a great question, and unfortunately, it's a real simple answer, and it goes like this. And when I was writing my other book, Area 51, there were a number of scientists, because I interviewed 75, you know, scientists and physicists, many of whom worked at Area 51 on these different weapons programs, and there were German scientists peppered, you know, among them. These are people who were part of Operation Paperclip, and the scientists told me, these are men who are now in their, like, 90s, we had no reason to believe anything other than what we were told by our superiors, that these were the good Germans. And, you know, like even in my interview, for example, with Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon, mm-hmm. The praise and perception of Von Braun as an absolute American hero is so embedded in one's mind, certainly in Aldrin's mind, you know, that it's impossible for them to, in my perception of, like, interviewing these people, they can't really unwind that, you know. It's not, and that has to do with the fact that this notion was propagated by the government. I mean, Von Braun used to, every now and then he would be sort of called to give testimony at a war crimes trial that was happening, this is in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And in these documents that I reviewed, you see Von Braun being coached by, you know, the director of NASA himself, saying, look, if there are any reporters there, afterwards you say what you always say. I'm, of course, paraphrasing, but this is the mm-hmm. essence. You say what you always say, which is, I have been thoroughly investigated by the U.S. military.
End of story.
As he had, but mm-hmm. they just didn't reveal what the investigation revealed.
My guest is Annie Jacobson. She's the author of the book Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. If you have a question or comment for Annie Jacobson, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Our conversation will continue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. This is Ann Fisher. After Nazi Germany fell in World War II, the U.S. took into custody some 1,600 Nazi scientists, in part to help the U.S. fight the rest of the war, but also ostensibly to prepare for the next Cold War. Still with us, Annie Jacobson, author of Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. Annie, you just referred to Buzz Aldrin's regard for Wernher von Braun. He's credited with creating the rocket that took America to the moon. How many of our advances in science and technology during that time could be credited to other Nazi scientists from the paperclip, Operation Paperclip?
This is, of course, another great puzzle of the narrative of the book and is not easily answered, and I think is will be different for everyone who reads it and decides themselves. But let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as you say, just broadly, we had these advances in rocketry. There's no doubt Von Braun's team got us to the moon. Could we have gotten there without them? Difficult to know. That's not how it rolled out. Our biological weapons arsenal and chemical weapons arsenals were created initially because of the Nazi science. Those programs were unilaterally destroyed by President Nixon, of all people. First time an entire weapon system had ever been created and then destroyed before it was even used. You have to ask yourself, I mean, and that was billions of dollars. Was it worth it? You know, the actual nerve agents that we're talking about, one that is has a current day thread to it is sarin gas, one of the scientists, perhaps the most horrible of all the men, and I don't use that word lightly, Otto Ambrose. A in sarin gas stands for Ambrose. And we see Assad's chemical weapons that are now being, you know, decommissioned, allegedly, as sarin gas among them. And so you have all these weapon systems, and then you also have the medical advances that we made. Dr. Hubertus Strughold is known as the father of space medicine. He's one of the men I profile, a very dark-hearted past and a very concerted effort by the government, just like with Von Braun, to whitewash his past. But let me give you the example of Theodore Benziger, because it's precise in a way. So when I began researching Theodore Benziger, I read his obituary, which published in the New York Times in 1999. And Benziger, at the age of 94, died. He's being lauded by the New York Times as this great physician for the U.S. military. He worked at the Naval Institute in Maryland. It also, you know, sort of boasts about how he invented the ear thermometer and how important that is. But what it leaves out, which is what I learned in my research process, that Theodore Benziger was a Luftwaffe doctor who was in the small circle of Heinrich Himmler, and that Theodore Benziger was the person that Heinrich Himmler chose to introduce a film of medical murder experiments that were going on in concentration camps. In other words, when Himmler wanted to show his friends this horrifying film at the Reich Air Ministry, he had Theodore Benziger make the introduction to show what the Luftwaffe was doing by experimenting on humans, all the amazing science that they were getting out of that data that would then serve the Third Reich, serve the pilots. And when you think about, now this is entirely left out of his obituary. It's completely unknown from his family members who I interviewed. And again, their answer is, well, if father was guilty, he would have been tried. Perhaps the most, just to end, the most complex situation about Benziger that I learned was that he was actually on the original list of defendants at the Nuremberg doctor's trial.
Which I was going to ask you, what did people in Germany, what did the folks running the trials, the Nuremberg trials, know about this program, and how could he be on that list and then wind up back in the U.S.?
That, you know, there are some things that are answered and there are some things that are not answered, like all good murder mystery stories, which this Operation Paperclip has many elements of, and Dr. Theodore Benziger is one of them. He was on the list of defendants, meaning there was enough evidence to put him in the Nuremberg prison and prepare the case against him at an international war crimes trial. And yet, mysteriously, here's the mystery, he was released. Who was he released to? U.S. Army Colonel Harry Armstrong, who would later become the Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force and who would start the Aerospace Medicine Facility Laboratory at Randolph Field, Texas, that got men to the moon. So you see the pushing and pulling, you see the strings, you see the tug of war between should we hire them or should we hang them?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, all these years later, those pieces of the puzzle come together, some of them more so than other, but of course the questions remain.
Not only were a lot of them hired, they were enriched.
You know, one of the great tragedies, I think, of Paperclip is that here you have these scientists that, as Albert Einstein said, were unfit for American citizenship because of what they had adhered to in the war. So, if not everyone was obviously working in a concentration camp and medical experiments, but almost all of these individuals, certainly the not just the 21 I profiled, but hundreds of them whose case files I looked at briefly, and you're going through to see, are they a Nazi Party member? Yes. Are they a member of a paramilitary Nazi squad? Yes. And when you look at it like that and you realize that ideology that they adhered to, that is, as Einstein said, you know, that you would think that would make them unfit for American citizenship. That is not the case, and the majority of these 1,600 were given that coveted U.S. citizenship, went on to live very prosperous lives, and you know, when they died, a lot of them had laudatory obituaries.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Annie Jacobson. We're talking about her new book. It's called Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. Otto Ambrose, you mentioned him, Ambrose, I guess, mm-hmm. He had been tried and convicted of war crimes at Nuremberg and served about 2.5 years in prison. But by 1964, he was very wealthy and rubbed elbows with captains of industry. How did he manage to scale the ladder from a manager of a factory at Auschwitz to the boards of directors of major mm-hmm. corporations? I mean, mm-hmm. he wasn't just making a lot of money. This was the elite. Did they know about him?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, Ambrose was a brilliant chemist. That's the sort of deal with the devil part of Ambrose that's so difficult to stomach. So back up for a moment. It's the war is in full swing. It's 1942, and Ambrose is considered at this point Hitler's favorite chemist. And I don't say that lightly. I found a document in the National Archives. I don't believe it was ever revealed before, that showed that Otto Ambrose was given a 1 million Reichsmarks bonus from Hitler himself. And the reason he was given that bonus was because he was a brilliant chemist. Not only did he co-invent sarin gas, but he was the inventor of synthetic rubber. And the Germans called that Buna. Now think about that. The tanks need treads. Mm-hmm. Aircraft need wheels, and the Reich needed rubber. They were running out of rubber supplies. And so when Ambrose invents synthetic rubber, Hitler just puts him at the top of his list of favorites. And that is how Ambrose wound up at Auschwitz, at the what is not as well known as Auschwitz-Birkenau, which is Auschwitz I and Auschwitz II. You have Auschwitz III just a few miles down the road, and that is the slave labor camp where synthetic rubber will be produced by slaves spared the gas chamber at Auschwitz. Some of these fellows I interviewed. Now, Ambrose was the manager of that factory. So he was hardly, you know, sort of a plant manager. He was overseeing this venture as the chemist who invented rubber. And it was that important to Hitler that he put his top chemist there. And that is why Ambrose was tried and convicted at Nuremberg of mass murder and slavery. And the fact that Ambrose was later given clemency is just really astonishing when you think of that in the big picture of what he was responsible for, how complicit he was in war crimes. And then to really add insult to this, you know, injury that sort of speaks that you can't even really put a number on.
Mm-hmm.
The judges took Ambrose's money away from him when he was convicted at Nuremberg. And after he was given clemency by U.S. High Commissioner for Germany, John McCloy, his finances were fully restored. So there he was, back in the good graces of his fellow countrymen and also the U.S., who later gave him a contract with the U.S. Department of Energy.
How much did the U.S., or tell us to what degree the U.S. validated this with the threat of the Soviets in the Cold War.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Validated is the wrong word, but...
No, that is a perfect word, because that's exactly what they did. You see, one of the interesting dramas of early Operation Paperclip is seeing that there are many generals in the Pentagon, because the program was run by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who created an organization specifically to run Paperclip. It was called JOA, the Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency. And you see some of these high-ranking generals right after the war in these transcripts that I reference in the book, you know, showing extreme opposition to this program, saying things like, I'm opposed and my colleague is opposed and, you know, we just beat the Nazis. Why are we bringing them here? I'm paraphrasing. That's the general gist of it. And then you see these others who are very gung-ho for the program and only see the science. They do not see the scientists. They see the science and they want anyone connected to that science. And they're saying, no, we must have this program. But then, as you speak of the Soviets, very quickly the Cold War becomes hot. And this is much earlier than even I, as a journalist, was really aware, that you're talking, you know, months after the end of the war, the Joint Chiefs of Staff get an intelligence report from a very secret organization called the Joint Intelligence Committee that they have providing them with intelligence, saying the Soviets are preparing for total war. That's the word they use, total war. And we must be prepared to fight them with atomic, biological, and chemical weapons, that ABC warfare mm-hmm. that originally began Paperclip's sort of movement into the national security wheel. And so the Joint Chiefs of Staff were in a bind. They have to keep the nation safe. They're being told the Soviets are preparing for total war. And Paperclip becomes what is called a denial program. We must deny the Soviets this science.
And was there evidence with 2020 hindsight that the Soviets were at that level of preparation?
That is a matter of great debate. I mean, I cannot answer that. Mm-hmm. What I do know is that if you look at but the Soviets were clearly trying to get the scientists. There's no doubt that it was a grab.
They were competing for them, yeah.
Absolutely. And it began in the weeks after the war, right there in Nordhausen. You know, I told you about the slave mm-hmm. labor tunnel in Nordhausen. That was in a place called the Harz Mountains. And while the Americans liberated that area, which is why we got those scientists immediately, we did not have control of that in occupied Germany. That territory was going to the Russians. We knew it. The Russians were up in Berlin. They had to march down literally to the Harz Mountain. And I write about all this in the book because it's like very dramatic that, oh my God, the Russians are coming. Quick, get the scientists. And we're rounding up the scientists, including von Braun, driving around the woods, essentially, army intelligence officers with a list, with von Braun on, you know, a list of names on note cards, knocking on doors in the mountains, saying, you know, oh yes, get this scientist, he's important. And we round up 115 of them and whisk them out of Nordhausen before the Soviets come. The Soviets arrive, and they do the same thing. They begin rounding up who's ever left. So they got their scientists, and we got ours.
Truly spoils of war.
Spoils of war, but in a way that we had never seen before, as
right.
far as I know, because we actually got the people.
Chris, in Lancaster, you want to talk about whether the Nazis had anything to do with Lyme disease. And I know, Annie Jacobson, then in your book, you do write about Eric Traub. He is the mm-hmm. Nazi scientist thought to be connected to Lyme disease. Chris, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, I was just wondering in your research if you found any truth to the fact that ticks or Lyme disease was infected mm-hmm. in ticks for biological warfare purposes.
Well, that was certainly a thread that I pursued and wanted to learn more about it. And here's what I learned. Eric Traub, who was number two to a paperclip figure that I write about at length named Dr. Bloma, who was the deputy surgeon general of the Reich in charge of the biological weapons program. Traub worked under Bloma, and he was sent by Himmler to Turkey to get, you know, viruses that were not available in Europe. So there's no doubt that Traub was a leading figure in the biological weapons program. He worked on an island in northern Germany, which was then later the island of Rems, which was later captured by the Soviets. So Traub initially became property of the Soviets. We wanted Traub. We got him for Operation Paperclip. He came to the United States. What I discovered in the archives was that Traub absolutely worked not only at Fort Detrick, which suggests he worked on biological weapons programs, but that also for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And that's how he wound up at Plum Island. Now, here's where it becomes very murky, so it's difficult to say what exactly he did and what he was responsible for, because those files are still classified. We do know that Plum Island was set up by a very, I know that, and I report in the book, that Plum Island was set up by a very important player in Operation Paperclip named General Lukes. He was in charge of the chemical corps. He was in charge of the sarin gas weapons, those Nazi scientists. And he organized the original construction of the Plum Island facility. But that's where it becomes vague. Traub's files are classified. What I found, a great mystery here, Traub, all of a sudden, in the early 1950s, asked to be repatriated to Germany. He's already been given his visa, his U.S. citizenship. He wants to be repatriated to Germany. And the government is involved in this push me, pull me, dare we let him go. They let him go. And then I have a file that shows that the FBI tailed Traub for most of his life. He went to places, you know, strange places like Iran. I had FBI reports, you know, showing him, the FBI agents tailing him there. They were always watching him in Germany. Is he an interesting character. And I look forward to the journalist who's able to crack that mystery of Traub, Plum Island, and potentially Lyme disease.
Chris in Lancaster, thanks for that call. My guest is Annie Jacobson. We're talking about her new book. It's called Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. One of those scientists wound up at OSU for some time. We'll talk about that and more when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. After the Germans fell in World War II, the U.S. took with them some of 1,600 Nazi scientists, in part to help the U.S. fight the rest of the war, but also to prepare for the next Cold War. Still with us, Annie Jacobson, author of Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. If you have a question, 614-292-8513, or you could email us at allsides@wosu.org. Richard in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Richard.
I'm on speakerphone there. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay. When you went to break, you mentioned Ohio State.
Right.
And that was my question. When I was a student at Ohio State back in the 60s, I had a German professor. And the scuttlebutt was always that her husband had been a German scientist. And I always wondered if he was one of the ones that was at Ohio State.
Do you remember her name?
Her last name was Edsa.
Okay.
I don't know if that would have been his last name.
Annie Jacobson, might this have any connection with Dr. Hubertus Strughold Day?
I don't think so, but what I will tell you that's fascinating is, you know, I've been on book tour, and at every one of my events, I've been speaking at bookstores around the country, And at every one of my 7 events, there has been 1 or 2 people in the audience whose father or uncle was part of Operation Paperclip.
Wow.
So the program was prolific, and I think that there are many, many questions that remain, because there is always the idea, well, my father was one of the good Germans, and while I am often asked that question, my answer is always, there is no way for me to know without looking at those individual case files and, you know, following up at the different archives in Germany, the Bundesarchives, where I went and interviewing individuals and finding that story. But the fact that the program was so big is very interesting, and also the fact that many of these scientists went to universities.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times after they did their weapons work at a military facility, they were sent on to a university laboratory where there was a different kind of contract with a different service, sometimes even the CIA.
Now, there is an OSU story, and Richard, by the way, thank you for your call. You said that there's an OSU story in your book about how the medical college at OSU unveiled a portrait of Dr. Hubertus Strughold Day, I might be mispronouncing, as part of a mural of medical heroes. And he was a top Nazi Air Force psychologist before that.
Yes. I mean, as far as I know, he was never at Ohio. So they just
had a picture
decided.
Of yeah.
I'm sorry?
They just included him in this mural then.
Which speaks to what an important figure he was in you know, American medicine at the time, that they would choose to put him up on their wall as a great figure of, you know, pioneering medical science. When in fact, Strughold was very controversial. He was the most important physician for the German Luftwaffe, and mindful of the fact that we now know absolutely without question that the Luftwaffe was conducting human experiments on people in concentration camps that killed many of them. It's almost impossible to think that the guy at the top of the chain of command didn't know about it. But Strughold's past, you know, many people have combed over it with a fine-tooth comb, including Simon Wiesenthal, and no specific evidence has come to bear that Strughold was directly involved. That he had knowledge is clear.
And his portrait was removed from that mural.
That's right. And there was also a library in Texas, the largest medical library, the largest military medical library in the United States, was named after him. And there was a great tug of war because many of his supporters refused to believe that he had anything to do with the Nazi Party, which is just fiction. But they were very stubbornly, were always at odds with these different groups that tried to say that Strughold had a nefarious past. But ultimately, when it was revealed in the 80s that Strughold had been on a war crimes list, even that medical library name was taken down.
You said that as of last year, the Space Medicine Association in America continues to bestow its prestigious Hubertus Strughold Award to a scientist or specialist for outstanding contribution to aviation medicine.
That's right. And there has just been so many articles written about Strughold showing that this should not be, I mean, it's not correct to name an award after someone with the kind of position that he had. But even worse than that, I found, is the case with Kurt Debus. Now, Debus was the first director of the JFK Space Center. He was a colleague of Von Braun's, and an award still continues to be given out in his name. Debus, I learned from his file, was a hardcore Nazi during the war. He actually wore the SS uniform to work in the laboratory. That was certainly not required. But worse than that, I found out that Kurt Debus, during the war, had turned over one of his science colleagues, his engineering boss, to the Gestapo for making an anti-Hitler remark. Now, this is something that Kurt Debus did on his own, as the record reveals. And that push and pull I was telling about, where you see one group not wanting, you know, being very opposed to the Nazi scientist program, and another group saying we must have these scientists, that it reveals itself in the file of Kurt Debus, because you have one group of people reading the documents about Debus and turning that colleague over and saying, this is a vicious Nazi, and he purposefully turned over a colleague. We cannot bring a man like this to the United States. And you see others saying, we need him for the rocket program, bring him over. That file was classified for decades. But when I found it recently, I read some of the language to the individual that's responsible for giving out that National Space Club Award in the name of Dr. Kurt Debus every year. And I said, what do you say when someone says to you, this man was an ardent Nazi? He turned over a colleague to the Gestapo. And I was told, no one's ever asked us that question before.
We have an email from Bostwick in Worthington. Writes, long ago, maybe in the 1960s, I learned the following quatrain. I make them go up. Who cares where they come down? That's my not my department, said Werner von Braun. Thanks for this important program. Gail in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Gail.
Yes, I'd like to know if your guest knows anything about IBM, the computer company, the huge computer company's involvement or complicity in any of these, the cover-ups of these people that we were trying to bring over, because I read a whole book on IBM's involvement in early in the war with all of their computer, huge computer machines, then were able to track down who was a Jew and who wasn't a Jew, and many of the people that, of course, that the Nazis found out through IBM were sent away to camp. So okay. I know that they were involved early in the war in helping Hitler and the Nazis.
Okay.
So I just wanted to know if they were involved in any of this cover-up or, you know, secreting the Nazis into the country.
Gotcha, Gail. Thank you so much.
Well, Operation Paperclip was a military program run by the Joint Chiefs of Staff that began immediately after the war. And it sounds like you're referencing some of the journalistic reporting that has been done about American corporations that were involved with the Reich leading up to the war, and then even continuing their involvement with them, their business relationships with them during the war. So that is a different subject. It's certainly an interesting one, but it's not part of Operation Paperclip, which is always spearheaded by the military and then co-run by the CIA once the CIA was created in 1947.
How complicit were universities? You said a lot of them wound up at universities teaching. Did the universities know who they were hiring?
Well, that's a great question. And as far as I can tell, no. And that speaks to the same issue of how could the American scientists not know they were working with, you know, Nazi scientists, and that's because they were told by their superiors, these are the good Germans.
These are the good guys.
And certainly that's what the universities were told, and the government was actually helping to place them in the universities and often giving a financial contract to the university to support the research of the scientists. So there would be no reason for the university to, you know, think anything untoward. Now, that changed when people like Einstein.
I was going to say.
So when Einstein, Eleanor Roosevelt, and other scientists in America got word of this, they became incensed, and they were very public. And I write about this in the narrative. You know, you see opposition to Paperclip rearing its head, but of course the military machine steps in very quickly to quash those ideas. And there are a couple really dramatic unveilings where individual journalists actually go to the mat. Imagine how difficult this information was to get in the 1940s. You know, you had to have a contact in Germany who could give you this information. But in a couple situations, certain of the individuals in Paperclip were unveiled to be hardcore Nazis. And you see the paperwork behind the scenes of the Joint Chiefs going, okay, you have got to put a kibosh on this. And they became more careful. And that's why I told you about Kurt Debus, for example. his Nazi past was at issue because people were worried, what if they find out what this man really did during the war?
You wrote about how different U.S. presidents dealt with the intelligence about this program. President Ronald Reagan, for example.
Reagan, an interesting thing happened with Reagan. That's right around the time when Otto Ambrose was given. Otto Ambrose, Hitler's favorite chemist, the man who was convicted at Nuremberg of mass murder and slavery, then given clemency. Right around the time Ambrose gets his U.S. Department of Energy contract, Jewish organizations inside the United States found out they had been following him. And they were incensed and made the issue public, as much as anything could be made public when the program's, you know, files and folders are classified. But I accessed from the Reagan Library some really interesting documents where President Reagan goes to his National Security Council and says, get me information about this Otto Ambrose character. And he is told, we can't find it.
You've written that millions more documents remain classified and that part of the problem is in locating the physical whereabouts of the documents themselves. And this is probably some of the stuff you referred to as there's a lot of other stories to tell out there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, and Otto Ambrose would be a case in point. So mm-hmm. I just told you that President Reagan, the president of the United States, cannot get information because his national security advisor is saying to him, oh, we don't know where this information is. Now, clearly, reading between the lines, that's a way to protect Reagan from information that he does not need to know.
Okay.
But then you have to say to yourself as a journalist, well, wait a minute. If Otto Ambrose came to the United States, as I discovered he did, two, perhaps three times, one time Dow Chemical was his sponsor, this is in the 1960s, and I said, well, then I'm going to look for the files of the State Department because this is a convicted Nazi war criminal. And to have gotten passage to the United States, he, as a convicted Nazi war criminal, he would have had to have been given special paperwork and a special visa by the State Department. And so I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the State Department seeking those documents about Otto Ambrose, and they came up lost or missing.
Your book asks two big questions. We've been talking about the first one, how did this happen? The other question was, what does it mean now? And Annie Jacobson, what does this mean to us now? I guess to know history is to hopefully to prevent it from happening again, but is there any way of knowing if this kind of thing has been happening all along?
Well, what it means to me is, first and foremost, is a reconciliation of certain facts. Facts need to be reconciled and go down on the public record, be it about Wernher von Braun or Otto Ambrose. But then the bigger question is, what does this really mean? And I think it's important to know that it would be impossible for someone like me or someone like you or 98% of the people who read Paperclip to be in the shoes of the Joint Chiefs of Staff facing what they are told is the potential for total war with the Soviets. And so one must empathize with the decision-making that had to go on at that high level. I don't have that kind of responsibility, and it would be foolhardy to say that I would know what that is like. And so I think taking that on balance is important. But then I really like reading and knowing and learning about the individual human stories, because that's where I find the moralities of the program become most revealing, and perhaps where you see individuals in government making mistakes or sliding down a slippery slope and perhaps not being able to undo what they've done. And that's why the ultimate is always, it comes back down to, for someone like myself, why I'm a huge proponent of transparency.
You said that in your travels during your book tour and so forth, that you often come across people who are related to one of the 1600, but they're always assuming that their relative was one of the good guys, one of the good Nazis. Have you learned about what has become of some of these people, and when their families find out how they ended up?
You know, I That's for individuals to research and report, and I've had many people contact me and say, you know, could you give me a tip on researching this at the National Archives, which I do. But I think when I think of in the big picture what I would say to that and what I do say to that, I would look to Albert Einstein, because Einstein was a German scientist living and working in Germany. And he left Germany immediately after the Nazis took power, and for a very specific reason, which he said. He said, science and justice are now in the hands of a raw and rabid Nazi militia. And he wanted to have nothing to do with it. And he very much stood his ground here in the United States, believing that anyone who stayed and worked for the Third Reich was part of that war machine.
Annie Jacobson, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Annie Jacobson, we've been talking about her new book. It's called Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.